This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Author Jedediah Purdy has a new book out called Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. In the preface, he writes, "This is a time of American prominence when America means many contradictory things to many people. Admiration, desire, resentment, and hatred clash and mingle together, born of conflicting ideas of what America is and means. We are on stage at the center of the world, and in others' eyes, we are what they want us to be, what they fear that we are, what they want to become, and what they loathe in themselves." Jedediah Purdy joins us now here in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks a lot, Neil.
If you have questions for our guest, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a phone call. Our number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Jedediah, like a lot of Americans, you've been wondering about the source of the world's love-hate relationship with the United States. Unlike a lot of Americans, you've actually gone out into the world to try to find some answers. When did you embark on this project?
I was actually working on this book in the spring and summer of 2001, before September 11th. And I was interested in the gap between American perceptions of the rest of the world and the world's perceptions of us. And I was sort of concentrating that question around the word empire, which has come to the center of American public conversation, but was way off on the margins then. And what I was trying to understand is, why is it that you can go almost anywhere in the world and people will talk about American empire as an uncontroversial fact? And here it's so alien, what seemed so alien then, that it was more of an insult than a conversation starter. Then after September 11th, I undertook a trip that I had been planning already in the course of the summer, and spent some time in Egypt, in India and Indonesia, Thailand and Cambodia, China, trying to talk to as many sorts of people as I could. Ordinary people, shopkeepers, entrepreneurs, students, westernized people, anti-American Islamists and Hindu nationalists, to try to get a feel for what was moving these different sorts of folks and their ideas of and their attitudes toward America.
You were in Cairo talking to people there while the United States was bombing Afghanistan,
yes.
Certainly a very controversial moment. And at the same time, you open the book with this wonderful scene of meeting with, you describe it, these young women, this particular young woman who's a lawyer, and you're sitting there having dinner in a TGIF's in Cairo, yes. And at the same time she's getting a message on her cell phone?
Yes. She's a very westernized young woman, and she's been explaining to me how her career is enormously important to her. It gives her a sense of identity and a place in the world. She has no space for the traditional role of Egyptian women. She and her sisters are nightclub goers. They're sort of party girls. They're dressed very fashionably. And this message comes in on her cell phone. It's a text message, and it's an advertisement for a dance party, or it's a caricature. And it reads, "Dance party bombs in World Trade Center. DJ Osama bin Laden flying courtesy of American Airlines." And this is absolutely delightful to these young women. They laugh. They explain to me, "This may seem strange to you, but to us, Osama bin Laden is a hero because he's the one who hit the United States." And yet these are young women whose whole lives are premised on the Americanization or westernization or modernization. And the difference among those is actually one of the themes of the book of Egyptian society in the last 30 years, which is exactly the sort of thing that Osama bin Laden's program is antithetical to. And I guess what I see going on here is that, like anyone, like Americans, people around the world tend to live in two different realms of the mind at the same time. On the one hand, the very practical business of getting by in life, living with the world you were given, trying to make something of it, getting some personal security, having some fun, taking care of your family. On the other hand, there's this temptation that I think everyone everywhere has to believe that everything that's confusing or disorienting or humiliating about our experience is going to be resolved and corrected in some momentous event, a revolution, an apocalypse.
A millennial event,
exactly. And in the Islamic Middle East, the form that that's taking is the an attraction to the stance of defiance and destruction that an icon like Osama bin Laden represents.
You went to a lot of other places, too, again, to talk about this idea of America as, you know, the most attractive place in the world and at the same time the most resented place in the world. One of the most interesting to me was when you were in Cambodia and you were visiting one of these places that, you know, we read about with some horror, you know, that we would consider a sweatshop.
Yes.
And you, one of the people you meet there is an American labor organizer. Mm-hmm. And the distinction between his approach and his opinion of what's going on at this factory
yes.
and the workers. Tell us about that.
Yes. This this was terrific. I spent some time shadowing this wonderful, very capable and admirable guy who's organizing local unions and assisting local union leaders in setting up an infrastructure that will keep their organizing efforts intact. new factories have sprung up around Phnom Penh in the last 5 years, and many of the people working in them, who are mostly women from the villages of Cambodia outside Phnom Penh, are in their first paying jobs, their first participation in modern capitalist society, really. And to say, there are three points of view on it that are relevant. First, there's the view of the American sweatshop activist or the American news observer who will look and see that these are women working long hours for low pay in lousy conditions in factories where our shoes are getting made. And that's the sort of classic sweatshop image. Then the guy I was following around sees himself as trying to build up a civil society and a culture of political engagement and workers' solidarity in a very traditional, idealistic, democratic leftist fashion mm-hmm. in Cambodia. He's trying to create a culture of solidarity, class consciousness, and struggle. And the workers have some of that going on, certainly. But the sort of exemplary moment for me was spending an evening with a local organizer and this American. And the organizer wanted to talk about his union, and he also wanted to talk about the CD-ROM he had just bought that contained English lessons. And as soon as he got access to a computer, he was going to start studying English. Then as we walked out of the organizer's shack in this little neighborhood of huts that rent for $10 a month, which is about a quarter of people's pay in the factories, we passed this little cramped, lighted room where 35 people from the sweatshop workers community were spending 2 hours, five nights a week, taking English lessons from someone whose English was passable, with the aim of getting up and out and taking the next step in this world of opportunity that they saw opening up for them in the factories. So I guess the thing I think that's revealed in all of this is that there's truth in all of these points of view about what's going on in globalization and global capitalism. It's exploitation, it is liberation and opportunity, and it's also a political question about whether it's going to be more of the one or more of the other. And that's where people like this organizer and people who are trying to give a democratic cast to globalization come in and tilt the rudder a little bit one way or the other.
Our guest is Jedediah Purdy. His new book is Being America. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's go to Corey, who's on the line with us from San Diego.
Good afternoon, Neil and Jedediah.
Hi.
My question for you, Jedediah, is when you were relating that story about the young women in Egypt, do you think that maybe their disenfranchisement or their perception of the United States is one that is takes into consideration that they like American principles, but they're kind of, you know, they see America as not living up to its own standard. The fact that, you know, we're still battling with affirmative action and Title IX, and, you know, of course we're making strides, but do you think that it's maybe the perception that we are not living up to our own idealism, and maybe not this hatred of America or Americans per se? I've traveled to a Muslim country, Malaysia, and they love Americans, and I'm an African American, so they, I think, pretty much knew that I was American, and you know, they were rushing over to, you know, talk to me and greet me and things of that nature, but you know, there was no malice. It seems that they're you know, sort of angry with policies and our own lack of living up to our own standards.
Yes. I think the paradox that I saw very often was people who were enormously warm toward individual Americans and talked about admiring Americans as a people, and who expressed their anger at the American government in particular. This was especially true in Islamic countries from Egypt to Indonesia, halfway around the world. And I think that at least some of this has to do with our hypocrisy, somewhat at home, because people are certainly aware of that. America is on the world stage, and Egyptians are very proud, for instance, of having a culture that they see as being much less racially hierarchical than ours. At least that's their self-image, and that's what they'll tell a visiting American. I think even more prominent, especially in the Middle East, is the fact that we've really taken on the role of imperial successor to Great Britain in that region, and we've made ourselves the sponsor of governments like Egypt's that have little popular support, and whose repressive measures and failure to bring economic opportunity have steadily increased the legitimacy of the Islamicist political opposition there. So the fact that the U.S., on the one hand, is the emblem of personal freedom, opportunity, security, the kind of future that everyone wants, whether or not they want it in America. But on the other hand, in these places, it's very specifically allied with the political forces that are part of what's keeping them from getting there, is a big problem. And I think hypocrisy actually counts more against us than it does against countries that are perceived as purely self-interested or imperial. There's a kind of backhanded compliment in the fact that people see American hypocrisy as a real problem, because I think the ideals are attractive enough that they'd like to see us live up to it, and there's an expectation that we should actually do better than other great powers do or have done, and an added bitterness when we do the opposite.
Okay. Absolutely.
Corey, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it.
All righty.
In the headlines here today at NPR News, NPR's Nick Spicer will report from Paris, France, that France, Russia, and Germany are vowing to stop the UN Security Council from passing a U.S.-backed resolution seeking authorization for war against Iraq. And NPR's Jennifer Ludden will have an update on the most recent troop deployments in the Persian Gulf. Both of those stories later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I wanted to get you to expand on the idea of empire that you were talking about, and a couple of concepts that you raise in the book that are sort of interesting, one of which is the invisible empire, and the other one, the empire of desire, but invisible empire first.
Sure. Absolutely. One of the things I think is most interesting about the American relationship to the world is that we think of the idea of our exercising imperial power as a very alien and unnatural one. And people elsewhere often find it obvious that that's what we do. I think there are at least two parts of the reason for this. One is that Americans have long been in the habit of thinking of ourselves as the universal nation, that being American is just being human. It's nothing more or less. There's a philosopher, English philosopher named John Gray, who said Americans suspect that everyone in the world is born American, and they become something else by accident or bad upbringing. And I think there's something to that. So that means that when we look abroad and see other people becoming more like us, we think, oh, no surprise there.
Because we've got the right idea.
Because we've got the right idea, and it's attractive. And the fact is, we see confirmation of that all the time. As a great immigrant society, we see people come here and literally become us, which I think it's a great civilizational achievement. But something we tend not to see is that because we, as they say, got here first with the most, here to the successful modern world, we're the ones who, intentionally or not, make the rules for everyone else. So, of course, in pursuing the things they want, they come to look more like us, but that's not always because being more like us is the part that they want. To be more specific, for instance, if you're growing up in India, you're growing up in China, you're growing up in Egypt, and you want to enter the world of global economic opportunity and mobility, that desire is a kind of universal human fact. But the fact that in order to do that, you're going to have to learn English, you're going to have to learn to be comfortable in a suit and tie, you're going to learn tennis, you're going to learn to talk about the NBA playoffs, these things have to do with the fact that America was the first great successful modern nation, and we created all the forms.
You talk about the Microsoft model a lot, and that, you know, English isn't necessarily the best language. It is the language you need if you're going to go ahead. There might be a better operating system, but unfortunately, Microsoft is the one we've got, and there might be a more efficient language. But English, if you want to get ahead in the world, has to be your second language.
Yes, exactly. We make the rules. If you want to do business, this is how you do it. And for us, those rules are natural. Speaking English, for me, is just speaking. For someone else, it involves both giving up something they were raised in and acquiring something that takes enormous effort and in which they're always a foreigner. So that's one thing. The empire of desire, as you said, is another. And that's that we, the desire to be comfortable, to be respected, to be secure in the world, takes on an American image and an American imprint. We present images of limitless prosperity around the world, and they're thrown up starkly on billboards and television screens and movie screens against neighborhoods of confused and disrupted and foreclosed lives in these cities of tens of millions of people that didn't even exist 50 years ago. And inevitably, we become the lightning rod of all the ambition that moves people and all the resentment and frustration they feel when they can't get with the hand what they want with the heart.
We're speaking with author Jedediah Purdy about his new book, Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. More of your calls when we come back from a break, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, as the economy sags, plans to limit development are meeting resistance in some communities. Slow growth in a slow economy. That's the next Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking with author Jedediah Purdy about his latest book, Being America. If you have a question, give us a phone call, 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And this we got from Steve Kundich in San Francisco. Living in America and having traveled quite a bit, I see it as the cultural elite of these nations trying to protect the rest of the rank-and-file citizens from American influences. It seems they're afraid that their cultural institutions will not stand up to those influences, and I'd like to hear Mr. Purdy's comments on that topic.
That's interesting. I think it's absolutely true that in India, for instance, the rise of Hindu nationalist politics has a lot to do with traditional upper caste elites feeling that their social status and prominence and practical economic privilege are threatened both by the dynamics of cultural and economic globalization and also by Indian changes at home that are giving more and more political power to lower castes and linguistic minorities and religious minorities. I don't know that I'm inclined to see the same thing going on in the Islamic countries that I've visited, though it's a question open to interpretation. There, often political elites are eager to use anti-American demagoguery as a way to reinforce their positions. That's certainly true in Egypt. But I think that's a little different from cultural elites who are concerned about the erosion of the local culture.
Let's go to Boston. Shannon joins us on the line.
Hi.
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 Gentlemen, I'm a future broadcast journalist, hopefully. I'm studying at BU, and I taught, I was a TA for a class last semester where we discussed with our students how America is perceived overseas as a result of our chief export, which we were trying to suggest is our communications, particularly movies and music videos. I wanted to know what you think. Can we change how we're perceived overseas, Jedediah, if we continue to produce the kind of this kind of export, you know, Hollywood and MTV and everything coming out the way it is? Can we change the way they see us if that continues?
I think it matters. In short, it matters, but it's not the only thing that matters. People do pay attention to the political actions the U.S. takes. People pay attention to what George Bush says even more than they pay attention to the political significance of the latest Hollywood blockbuster. I mean, I think there's no question it matters a lot. And one of the most interesting things that's happened actually throughout much of the world, especially in India and East Asia, is that global American-born networks like MTV are reshaping themselves into local versions, so that there's an Indian MTV and there's an East Asian MTV. And the Asian network, Star TV, has its own competitive music channels. And these are both like and unlike the American original. And I think you'll continue to see more and more of that as
franchises.
Yeah.
They're franchises.
They are franchises, but they have very different content depending where they're selling.
Shannon?
And there's an organization, I believe that a woman by the name of Charlotte Pierce resigned yesterday. She was in charge of improving our image overseas. Is that kind of an organization going to help, do you think? And who should be the one to come in and step in? What kind of person can replace her?
From what I understood of the work that organization was doing, and Charlotte Beers is a marketing expert, branding expert, who was basically hired to advertise the U.S. abroad, it seemed to me that it was a little condescending, actually. I mean, I think that broadcasting honest discussions and careful inquiries into things like the place of Muslims in America and American attitudes toward Islam could be very productive, but you can't talk down to people, and you can't produce second-rate ads for people. People are actually very, very savvy about these things, and assuming any less makes for a bad ad, and I think any American TV viewer knows that nothing is more counterproductive than a bad ad.
Shannon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And good luck with your career, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Wanted to ask you, Jedediah, you wrote your first book, you were 24, you're now 28. What effect do you think it had as a young person to go around and talk to people, you know, as opposed to geezers like me?
I think it actually mattered a lot because I was able to get people my own age and older, but especially contemporaries, to open up very comfortably. I didn't come to them as a representative of the American media or the American government. There was whatever triggers move people to give you the party line, I wasn't setting off. People, I think, talked to me much more as a peer or just a curious interloper. So I do think there was a certain openness that I was able to take advantage of, which was really fantastic. I didn't have to depend on my taxi drivers for spontaneous conversations.
On the other hand, though, was it a little daunting to come back and write a book about political philosophy and about America's relationship with the world, a meditation, as you describe it, on foreign affairs?
Yes, but it seemed like the appropriate thing to try to do under the circumstances, so I did what I could.
Okay. Let's go to Peter, and he's on the line with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I just wanted to talk about my wife and her experience in this regard. I met her in Indonesia when she was pretty young, and one of the parts about it just leaves me breathless is that her mother grew up essentially in a grass hut in Borneo as a member of the Dayak tribe of indigenous people. So within two generations, we have someone who came from Dayak culture to Jakarta and its Islamic schools, and now is fully ensconced in the United States with a Nordstrom's card and an SUV. And watching that transition has just been amazing. One of the things I think that's worth mentioning is that it's quite different for her and her women friends and her sisters from the type of socio-political analysis that seems to me kind of male, in that their primary experience of American and Americanism is the star system and you know, shopping experiences and so on. And I don't want to belittle that, because it was a real eye-opener to watch them at first idealize these things and then realize, you know, that really wasn't, you know, sort of America's purpose or, and, you know, her life has become much more Indonesian in the last couple of years as compared with the first few years she was here. So I'm wondering if you have the experience of talking to a lot of, I don't know, looking at this from a more sort of cultural as opposed to a political perspective.
That's a really helpful question. I hope you'll take a look at the book in your library. I don't mean to pitch it to you. Because actually a lot of what I'm trying to do in the book is not just talk about politics on the level of pronouncements by presidents and constitutions and big political philosophical principles, but really look at the way that people's political attitudes and their big pictures of culture and history, the kinds of things that move both American liberals and radicals and nationalists in places like India and the Islamic world, how these motives are born in and take their power from people's very particular and intimate experiences, what happens to them on the streets, what happens to them in their homes, the little events that make them feel powerful and capable or make them feel lost and humiliated, and the kind of intersection between the jumbled passions of ordinary life and the grand themes of politics is really, in large part, what this book is about.
And also, I mean, you also write a lot about the transitions that Peter's describing of people moving from, you know, bamboo huts or their equivalent in various places to either big cities in their own countries or then overseas. And you'd write a lot about the politics of the diaspora, for example.
Yes. Yes.
Right, I think. Can I talk a second?
Yes, you can.
One of the things I think is so amazing is how about America is the that might be unique in history is the class trajectory that an experience like my wife's allows. And in other words, her brothers never had a single pair of shoes in their lives until I bought them a pair, and they're not children. And yet here in America, we don't think much. I mean, I don't suppose it's true for everybody, but I don't think that's an unusual experience at all, that you have this capacity to move in history through classes that I don't think ever occurred until maybe after the Second World War. I mean, you just didn't hear about things like this, and now it's all but commonplace. It's just, I kept saying it leaves me breathless, but when you look at history, things don't change much, and now they're changing very, very fast.
Yeah, you know, one thing that's interesting in that vein, there's a lot of reason to find optimism, cause for optimism in the kind of transitions you're describing. And then at the same time, as de Tocqueville noted about the French Revolution, revolutions don't happen when people are downtrodden and staying in the same place generation after generation. They happen when people are on the move, when there are rising expectations, when people expect more from their lives, and then the frustrations and defeats come to feel much, much sharper, and people's responses are much more likely to take a violent turn. So there's great prospect of both hope and instability and the kind of movement of peoples and growth of hope for individual lives that you're describing.
Peter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jedediah Purdy is with us. His new book is Being America. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I wanted to follow up on a thought that was contained in your last answer, and that is on the the politics of grievance around the world that is used to justify a lot of things. And what you talk about in this country as an almost a genius effect of the American people's amnesia, that they're almost unable to remember anything, and how positive a development that is.
Yes, it's absolutely a great paradoxical virtue of American culture. That if you listen to the political discussions, and I mean in the mosques and public rallies, not just in parliament, of countries around the world, you'll hear invocations of countries' imperial experiences, of the wrongs that the Hindus did to the Muslims, and then that the Muslims did to the Hindus, and so on and so forth. So that you're born into a history of grievance and retribution. And I want to emphasize, a lot of this is actually being produced by political opportunists now.
It's
not, exactly. It's not that people are trapped in history, but that demagogues are making history into a weapon.
I remember in Belfast once a Protestant woman told me, "We live away in 1690 and think we should." And I was just astounded by that.
It's a different world, as you say. The American genius for forgetting enables us to do things like undergo a revolution in race relations in this country, and now live as though we didn't remember that 80 years ago this was essentially a white supremacist country in its public political culture. You can say that there's a shame in forgetting, but there's also a triumph in forgetting, because it reduces the sense of injury and disruption and change. And it fixes people's eyes on the future.
Let's see if we get one last call in. This is Thomas in East Lansing, Michigan. We just have a couple of minutes, Thomas. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I just wondered if Mr. Purdy could comment on the idea that maybe Western-based multinationals sort of are creating an empire of capital. I heard you guys talk about a couple of other empire concepts. It's just the thought that the methods and the priorities of these giant companies are not the priorities and the methods of the U.S. citizens, and that's how we're being judged on our companies and not on our ideals.
Yeah, Edmund Burke, who was a great critic of British imperialism in India in the 18th century, at the time when British Empire there was being conducted by the British East India Company, which was a commercial outfit rather than a governmental outfit, said that the British were the worst imperial governors India had ever had, worse than its Muslim conquerors, worse than the Persians who took over part of northern India in another period, because the others had come to stay, and they'd yoked their destinies to the destiny of the place. But the British came and took and left, and he said all India ever sees is wave after wave of birds of prey and passage. That is, they come, they prey on the place, and they go. And I think to the extent that that's the nature of the American commercial presence abroad, it's a very troubling thing. At the same time, you have the other face of it, which is what we were talking about in the Cambodian laborers' neighborhoods.
Thomas, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Jedediah Purdy, appreciate you coming with us to be with us in Studio 3A.
No, thank you so much. This was really fun.
Jedediah Purdy's new book is Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.